Welcome, everybody. This is The Disposable Web, the sequel to the Social Business Hangout, available on iTunes. My guess is...
Robin Dickinson from Sydney, Australia.
Now, Robin, we've talked previously online during the 42 plus 1 live to air, and a few years have passed, a good 5 years, I would say, or getting close to that mark. A lot has changed in those 5 years, and a lot of what the Disposable Web is all about is exactly that. What has changed, you know, in the last 5 years or so? And I always say the internet of 2015 is not the internet of 2008, nor is the workplace, nor is society and whatnot. So it's my opportunity to gauge what has changed. You have a perspective that is literally halfway around the world. You know, I live in Canada, you live in Australia. Before we get into any of the aspects of that, I'd like you to maybe elaborate on what you do, what your target audience is, and that might set the tone for the context, if you will, of the elements we're going to talk about.
I'm a manager, a partnership consulting firm. It's my firm. I have partners within that firm. That is in the business development space for medium to large organizations, typically multinationals, that are seeking to develop business. We have four arms to the business. One is straight business development consulting. What's the strategy? What are the tactics? What's the way forward? What's the direction the company needs to take to grow sales, to grow business, to grow revenue? Secondly, we offer the training and tactical coaching. I do a lot of mentoring, particularly at senior management level, around this is what we're doing. Pressure test it for us, make it better for us, or just be professional ears to hear us out. Thirdly, we have a digital development arm where we offer sales tools, apps, etc. Because especially in the large business space, sales representatives are using more apps, business developers are using more apps, and that's integrating into things like the organizational systems and processes around CRM, etc. But everything we are aimed at, the company is called Diamond Focus Solutions. Everything we're aiming at is diamond focused, absolutely focused on what has to happen to develop revenue. So our fourth arm is talent recruiting. And we offer talent recruiting in a very different way because we're strategically involved with our partners. We know their business. We're helping them recommend strategies and tactics. We also find great opportunities to place talent that can hit the ground running in their organizations. When we place someone, they immediately hit the ground. Their lag phase is shorter. And their fit to strategy, their fit to the business is much higher than the standard recruiting model. So we have an integrated system of advice, expertise, talent, tools, etc., diamond focused on sales revenue development. Because what I concluded after years of consulting in business development, that you can do anything in a company as long as you're making sales. And what I mean by that is we can get all cute and clever around strategies and tactics and ways forward. Unless that money is coming in the door, you really are in trouble. And so I really want to be the guy who helps get revenue in the door. On a micro scale, I do a lot of mentoring and a lot of gratis work for small business and entrepreneurs in my own time to give something back. I'm frequently with people who have got the big idea, who are using the Disposable Web, for example. And I'm part of a group in Sydney who do that as, if you like, sort of like a mini board of directors that help people with big ideas, young, small, old, large, doesn't matter. So the other side of my business is I'm an emerging contemporary artist, and I spend at least half my time now developing my art business. But the business side of me manages the creative side of me, if that makes any sense. I got two little angels on my shoulders. One's the mad creative artist, and the other is the commercial guy. And they have lots of conversations, and I find it quite easy to move between highly creative and highly commercial. And that offers fresh twist in the art community as well, because as you know, there's a struggle that often creatives have between the idea that I'm making money out of my creativity. And I cross that bridge easily because I spend all my time in the commercial world. So that's sort of in a nutshell. I'm a family guy. I've got my family. We live in Sydney. And It's the most beautiful place on earth other than Canada.
Right now, as you say, you're about to hit the beach and I'm basically shoveling driveways. So it's a bit different in that sense. But we do have natural beauty for sure. One of the things that I did in my previous podcast was focus on interviewing people in the Brantford area. So it really gave me a very local feel to, let's round it up to just e-commerce, which is, you know, where operations meets sales, which meets marketing, you know, and everything kind of coexists in a way where a community is benefiting both socially as well as financially, you know, commerce in my wild definition. And one of the things I found out was a lot of what I was hearing was supplementable, meaning you could put it somewhere else in the world. And a lot of those life lessons and business lessons were not unique to just Brantford. They could be in Toronto or they could be in Sydney. But there's always a twist. In our case, we call it, you know, the Brantford vibe. What's business like in Sydney? And maybe something you said in a previous conversation triggered something. Your day starts on New Zealand time and follows the sun from that point forward.
Sydney is the largest populated city in Australia. You know, it hovers just over 4 million, which on a global scale isn't a very big city. But for Australia, for the amount of land there is, it's the largest metropolis. That makes it useful for a business point of view. You can run a business here, such as mine, which is a high-end consulting business. You can set up a shop. And if you're, you know, if your timing's right and you're good enough, I guess you'll you can make a business out of pretty much anything in Sydney. It's also got a very international feel and a large churn of international people coming through. And most big businesses have a Sydney branch. So what I like about Sydney is it's really the international hub for this side of the world. As I say, my day starts, New Zealand is 2 hours ahead of me, but then everybody else we're ahead of. So I can really set the agendas for all of my international clients and be in their in tray when they hit the desk. So I really like in my world for my clients to receive value from us first. So they log on and they're going to have something in their in tray from us if they're in the Middle East or if they're in Europe or if they're in China or Singapore. And I really like following the sun through the global calendar of the day, as opposed to being on the back foot. When I'm in Europe traveling, I know Australians are coming after me, and I prefer to be on the front foot, if that makes any sense.
It totally makes sense, because you and I have done collaborative projects in the past where, well, in this particular case, I'm a full day behind you. You know, it's currently 7 p.m. and at your end of the world, it's 11 a.m. the next day.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Exactly.
So I know the difficulties involved in, you know, dealing with cross time zones and whatnot, but I also know there's a value to it, because to your point, you setting the agenda for tomorrow, in my case, by the time your day is done, my Thursday is starting.
Exactly. And when you think about the calendar, I mean, I don't want to get all metaphysics of time on us, but...
But I think it does play into the telecommuting aspect of what I want to talk about, so...
Oh, very much so. The chronology is such that if we set up a project, if you and I set up a project we go, okay, Thursday lunchtime, we're going to do X. Well, I get to do X Thursday lunchtime before you and experience that part of the task and then get to report back to you or manage or coach or critique you. And I just my personality style, and because I'm selling advice and consulting, I just prefer that to be the situation, because that way, by the time you arrive at it, I can add value to that. I've kind of been the advanced party, if you like. And collaboratively, that's very, very strong for my style of business.
And to your point, by the time someone at this end of the world would be done, you're starting your next day. So if you think of it as a daily iteration, you know, using agile project management as a model, you know, we're looking at very fast 24-hour scrums on very specific, as you say, diamond-focused tasks. Whereas, you know, if you were just in a local community, you're done or you're working a lot of overtime for no reason.
It's very true. And the other thing about that, Robert, is you can work a 24-hour clock. So, for example, I've got colleagues in Asia. I've got colleagues in Europe. And I'll work on a document and flip it to them. So while I'm sleeping, they're working on it and they flip it back to me. So productivity, really, as long as you've got complementary skill sets and you're not just reinventing the wheel, your productivity is vastly increased. And our outputs are much higher. Our revenues are much, much higher now that we're mastering a global virtual business development model. We need to talk a little bit about that virtual thing, because that starts to get into the web, the telecommute, etc. Now, you and I have never actually met.
Nope, ever. We may have a total of a week's hard time interaction between the two of us, all remote, mostly via Skype and to a certain degree Dropbox and, you know, some Google products and stuff like that. And it's actually something that you and I kind of hinted at in your day-to-day work life. And this is the one thing that has really changed, you know, a lot in the last 5 years is, you know, we have all these platforms that are available to us, whether or not it's an antiquated SharePoint that has still gone through a lot of good iterations in the last 5 years, to SAP, to CRM systems, to video conferencing. You know, you're no longer having to go into a specially dedicated building with a specially dedicated room to be able to have a business conversation with someone that you're collaborating with halfway around the world. And more importantly, it costs you nothing now to do that. So how does that play into, you know, the workspace when you go and consult to your clients? Is it something that comes up a lot, or are they still mostly focusing on between these four walls, if you will, of their business?
If you're operating a business like me, which is a virtual global, everything's run off a laptop. You have the other devices. You move between phones, Skype, some of the platforms, for example. There's a Chinese app that has a telecommuting telephone function much better than Skype. That doesn't drop out as much. So what I'm saying is, you get a suite of tools that you can rely on, but you're very focused to the point that face to face is the key. That everything else is a very poor surrogate for a replacement for face to face, particularly if you're wanting to do any kind of decent sized business. If you wanted to do any long-term business, if you're wanting to get real collaboration. And we're very mindful of that. Anybody in the bigger B2B space is clearly aware of that. You've got to get on a plane and you've got to sit in a room and you've got to eyeball someone to really make things happen. Does that mean to say that's the only way? No, I'm just talking purely from my experience. Issues we have is we get into big organizations, we go and meet them, and then you do things like you have to do large file transfers. Now, inside big companies, they've got all their own servers, they've got all their own protection, et cetera. And you'd think moving a 5 megabyte document would be fairly easy. Things like that become major issues. Things like having a telecom. You know, you get one or two people on a Skype call, but no, big organizations won't use unsecured apps. So if you're doing anything, there's a confidentiality agreement between us and clients very quickly, and that excludes then any non-secure app. So you can't use Skype, you can't use Dropbox, you can't use any of these things. So suddenly you're into a world of massive file transfer with being very difficult to do. So I ended up the other day chopping up a prospectus for a client in Germany. I had to break it up into 6 emails. This is the old dial-up days. So disposable, it's just round and round in this sort of loop, you know. So it's very easy to get carried away with unsecured apps as being a way to build a business. I'm frequently talking to entrepreneurs who are starting up and they've got all these tools and stuff. Well, be very careful because what you think you're building a business on. And okay, not everyone's got to move massive files and all the rest of it, but these are unsecured. These are owned business models. They're all owned by someone who's trying to advertise something. And so you've got to be very, very mindful that there's almost like a facade of web. So when you said to me disposable web, that disposable nature for me is, say, I always think of it as have a light touch with it. Don't become reliant on it and be very careful about what expectations you're building up to build a long-term business on.
Kind of ties into some of the stuff that you and I have talked into the past. And it's one of the reasons I wanted to bring this up, because part of the allure of, you know, what we have right now in this age of platforms and whatnot is all the stuff you just brought up is they're there, but let's be honest, they're not your systems. And it's the old debate between what is IT versus, you know, what's crowdsourced, you know, and that type of stuff. There comes a time in a business where you have to grow up. And the question there is, yes, as you say, you can run a lot of smaller businesses and whatnot using these tools, but it comes at a price, and that price is the risk of security. You know, we see all of these systems where emails are being leaked and stuff like that, right? And even just recently in the States, a big article about how a major person in the government was using their own private email server at their home, you know, with a fake account, and the amount of secured information that was going on through there. And this is the U.S. government. So it's, you know, it's tempting to say, yeah, we can just load up these free tools. But then, as you say, the reality of what happens when the shit hits the fan, or the feet hit the ground, if you will.
Well, this is the thing. And I mean, I haven't changed my view on business. I mean, I'm the older generation. My next significant birthday will be 60. Believe it or not, I do take all the appropriate measures surgically and pharmacologically to stay looking so young and fit.
It's the Australian weather, I tell you.
It's the Australian weather and the lifestyle and a very cheeky sense of humor. There is no shortcut in business. I'm the heretic when it comes to this. Sooner or later, somebody's got to pick up the phone, make an appointment, and go and see someone and sell something and then deliver it. The idea that there's a shortcut, fast track, hacked way, et cetera, is people selling content to upgrade you to their book, their seminar, et cetera. That's a business model in itself. The disposable web is a product mall in itself. To me, it's got more distractions away from true business. We've made more revenue in the last 2 years by putting the disposable web in the disposable section, not in the hardcore, hard framing section of our business modalities. So say, for example, if I see things on PowerPoint presentations, if I see them on spreadsheets, as opposed to bank deposit slips with actual transactions on them, people are dealing with me through emails we haven't actually met, if I'm reading people's personalities from their Facebook stream, etc., or from their blog posts, which are becoming more and more similar as people have used up all the superlatives you can use of must see, must watch, unmissable. What happens when it all became unmissable and we all became famous? So we're all over that now.
When everything is awesome, there is no more awesome.
That's right. Exactly. So we've played every superlative you can play. And so now we get back to the gravitational force of somebody's got to pick up the phone and make an appointment. And most of my business now comes from the almost sigh of relief in companies that go, thank goodness, we're back to something that's going to put money in the bank account. And that's not to make it wrong, Robert. I've got a digital section in my company. Reason I have is I've got a top performer who's right at the leading edge of digital to make sure we stay relevant, to make sure we help companies make more astute decisions about how to use digital. And I don't believe you can do that without participating in it yourself. You know me, Robert. I'm online. I've been in social media for a number of years. All of my art sales come from my Instagram and my Facebook streams. I'm there. But all I'm saying is, as a commercial guy, be very, very careful of the amount of time and effort invested. Most people who spend their time online using the social media platforms, I find, do not value their own time, meaning they don't make their billable hours. If they said that, well, what am I worth, $200 an hour, whatever you bill yourself at, if you added up the amount of hours you spend and the revenue you got back, you would very quickly stop using these platforms and go out and make telephone calls and knock on doors. The point is, if you don't value your time, if you spend 20 hours on something, it doesn't matter because you don't value your time. But commercially, you must value your time.
There's the two sides to the equation. It's only when marketing meets sales and sales meets marketing and operation is able to coincide with product development and product release. You know, all of those things need to work. And to your point, if nothing's coming in the door, i.e. sales, it doesn't matter how many of these layers are properly focused or whatnot. You've got nothing that is generating income for your business at a value point that is making you profitable. And that, if you're building your model on anything that does not have a balance between the income stream and the expense stream, you've got a problem financially as a business. So one of the things that I'd like to ask you, because I really want to focus on the sales aspect of that, is if we were to take a look at the evolution of sales over the years via different eras, to as far back if you want as to when it was a small community of 10 people working in a business and it was all barter, to, you know, what it is now. And then maybe walk me then through perspectives of that, maybe in different cultures that you've, you know, interacted with. Because to your point, there's the Asian culture, there's the European culture, there's the North American culture, and then there's where you're from and your point of view, right? So maybe both sides of that, if you will, and blend it together? Because I know you can.
It's a quite an easy one, Robert, because I often lament to the people in my sphere, because I do a lot of senior executive mentoring now. I don't believe such the sales model has changed since the Roman marketplace, the medieval marketplace, the Persian marketplace, where you had product, you had a set of customers, and you had a transaction, and you were competing for awareness, you were competing for differentiation, you were competing for loyalty, you were competing for valuable use of your hours and efforts to get a return. And I keep that model very, very close to my mind and heart at all times when I'm in business. I'm thinking to myself, the second I get too far away from that kind of marketplace mentality, then when they become layers that make it sound interesting, that always sounds good to people when people say, you know, we found the easy way or whatever. And that model really hasn't really changed. And to that point, I regularly go down to the local markets with my family, and we've set up stores. I've been selling art at the local market, where you got to get the people coming over and you got to talk and sell and transact and take the cash, et cetera. Because I like being in the local community, but also to keep front and center the basic sales transaction. And we've been teaching our boys that as well, that it comes down to that. Now, how's that changed through the years? Well, we had obviously the Industrial Revolution. We've had automation. We've had the knowledge economy. And what actually happened is something got slipped onto the table. In negotiation, we call this an intangible. And what got slipped onto the table, we not only got systems and processes that were facilitating communication, global time zones, etc., but in that came implicitly a business model that people found that they could sell people the dream of the efficiency, right? Now, I've consulted to the SAPs of the world, and I know a lot of the value proposition, yes, the ERP systems is incredibly valuable, but a lot of that, especially when we came around to year 2000 and the millennium bug and all that, was all about the perceived benefit, the perceived, you know, we'll sell you the way the systems and processes that will make your life easier, okay? Now, that's great, and people like Apple do this, for example, with iPads and iPhones. They kind of sell you a way of making life easier. And that's a whole marketplace. So online, you can subscribe to things, you can buy things, etc. But that is the industry. It's like the self-help industry. People giving you tips on a blog to help you upgrade to the book, to upgrade to the seminar, is a business model. So what I'm saying is, as the web developed, for example, so did the web business model or the web shop. So another way I interpret disposable web is the disposable web is a commercial entity unto itself, selling itself. Now, can you really trust that? You know, when the agenda is to sell you something, can you really trust that has your total best interest at heart? Well, only to the extent that the thing that's selling it to you believes it can do a better job for you. Now, I've never been more efficient with Microsoft product, ever, never. I've never been more efficient. I'm much more efficient writing with a pad. And you could say, well, Robin, you're just a doddery old man. You don't know how to use the technology. Well, why should I learn how to use the technology? Microsoft, with their billions, are supposed to make the user experience easier. So I use very crude versions of Word and PowerPoint, et cetera. If you're using a PowerPoint presentation in a presentation, for example, I think you're lazy. I think nothing convinces a group more. I was in China recently. Didn't use any PowerPoints. I mean, with the executive board of a major Chinese company with European representatives, my first 50 seconds of the appointment of the meeting with the executive team were in fluent Mandarin. That got more attention and got more respect and honor for the next hour and a half of negotiating than any amount of Seth Godin PowerPoints with the big picture and the thing, right? I'm not having a crack at people. What I'm saying is you are the one that sells. There's a whole infrastructure being created, a commercial channel in itself called the web and associated tools and things around that. And let's just be really clear of the role of that. So in terms of an evolutionary force, we grew up the tools, but the tools got seduced into becoming a sales channel into itself. So I see frequently, for example, mentoring entrepreneurs who don't have any money, who haven't banked anything, who will quickly go and get the iPad and this and that. And I say, how do you justify that with no sales? Oh, but it'll help me get sales. Well, how's that different from knocking on a door or just ringing someone up and getting the appointment? Yeah, but I need a website. And that mad loop is really, I think the web's done a fabulous job of selling itself as a weight-bearing or mission-critical part of any business model. And that's just good selling. I think they've just done a damn good, the royal they, we, have done a fantastic job selling the irreplaceable nature of the web for you to do anything nowadays.
We've learned how to sell the web to a point where it's considered not disposable, but essential services. We've done such a good job of building an entire commercial industry around that concept. Yeah. There's got to be some great nuggets in there to go, hey, if you took this and you applied it to widget A or widget B, you know, and you know what I mean when I say that, because sometimes you and I do have a language barrier, but what would be some of those nuggets, if you will, that you might pick up on?
What happens, Robert, is you go, well, here's how to make money. Do SEO, do website design. These are widgets that I think that if you've got a way of a better user interface or service delivery or some kind of fresh twist, I think it's in those areas that you're going to see. For example, you wouldn't set up a television studio now. You wouldn't set up a video shop now. You wouldn't set up a CD. You wouldn't set up a music studio anymore. You know, you're just not going to make any long-term money unless you're stealing share from the others who are already dying in the ice age. You know, the big dinosaurs lumbering onto the ice going, oh, I think I can make a profit. You know, I think it's in selling. Remember in the gold rush days, you don't want to be the guy going for the gold. You want to be the guy selling the sieves and the shovels and the stick of dynamite. And they're all the widgets that I think, how can we apply this? Why do you think I got a digital stream? I'm not out there telling clients they don't need digital. I'm saying, well, if you're going to buy digital, let us help you, right? And that's a revenue stream. Is that corrupt? No, because they're buying digital. They see digital as relevant. I see digital as relevant. But I'm just saying at the end of it all, I need to know what's going to go in the bank. Okay, and if I'm deciding that the web's a part of my business model, I better make damn sure I know at what it's costing me and what the returns are, short and long term.
It goes back to, and I hate to say the word, but it comes back to the ROI of anything that you do. The thing with return is you can measure, as you say, on dollars and cents. You can return it on so many different layers, depending on whether or not you're a charity and it's a goodwill or you know, there's always a way of measuring return. It's not necessarily dollars, but if you are a commercial entity, there is only one way to measure that, and that is the return on that investment in income, because otherwise you're not there for commerce.
You've got to be very real about what the investment is. And I say, if you do not value your time, for example, in my art studio, when I employ my artist to do the art, which is me, we have very strict guidelines on how much time a painting must take, what size it must be, how many materials it must use, how it must be framed, etc. I went up to the local framer and we worked out the sweet spot where he would get the minimum wastage by cutting frames for me and the maximum returns. And he said in his 25 years of doing business, he's never had an artist bother worrying about his waste. And I get a great price for my frames because we work in collaboratively. Now, there was no internet there. That was just... I was thinking about how we can both make money and come up with a solution that he was very happy with, okay? So I know what my costs are for every single creative piece that's out there, and I price accordingly so I get a real profit. You can say, oh, well, that's you, Robin. You're just a finicky guy around profit. No. If you're in a publicly listed company running it, you are accountable for that. What's the difference between that and a small business? None. It just depends on whether you want to eat or not.
What I've loved in the conversations I've had locally is they're that ma and pa level of business, you know. But yet at the end of the day, they measure it on one very simple thing. Am I getting fed today? Are my kids, getting clothes? Or, you know, it's that real reality that I think sometimes we forget at the larger corporation. Like I've had, you know, a staff with a budget of, let's say, around 3 million. So a significant amount of people. I guarantee the majority of the people that were bringing in six figures or high five figures had no real care or understanding about how the business made money. And those businesses are failing and they wonder why. Recently, I've gone to a lot of businesses, be it food or bar related. Most of them don't know the cost of creating a drink or the cost of creating a meal. For your basic menu items, you don't know the profit margin or the upsell margin. And that's like the waitresses aren't informed that stuff. So because they don't know how to do the upsell. And to me, I've always been a man of yield. I'm horrible at sales, but I can find a yield on something that's been sold.
You're pretty good on sales, Robin. Well,
my point being, I'm better at yield, meaning I can find that margin. I could find the missed opportunities. Something you said earlier, I use the term, I give that outsider's point of view. I come into your business, I walk through those doors as the owner of your business on day one, and I'm seeing things that you stopped seeing 5 years ago. Like, did you know that you could move that? Or what does that plug do? You know, and those type of things. So what I'm getting at and all of that is, to your point, commerce, you can have the sales, but I think there's that extra aspect of how do we make sure that the people that are involved in the process have that same awareness of that sales mentality of this is what it costs, this is what it needs to make, this is how optimal we have to be able to stay afloat.
I agree with that. I think another significant thing I've seen evolve in the sales space is getting rooms full of people, this big conference model for training, for briefings, et cetera, et cetera. I think this is one where web does have a big role to play in terms of communication. I think that's becoming a very expensive operation for people, and a reliance that it can't be justified as much as it used to be. So I'm seeing less of that. And if they are doing that, there's for shorter amounts of time. So people are being much more respectful of filling a room full up with executives is lost opportunity and lost time. I do think people do need to get together and debate and discuss, of course. But compared to, say, around year 2000 and before then, that's definitely leaned down.
In 1999, I was selling a basic website for $1 million, which would now be the equivalent of a $1,000 WordPress site in terms of content and complexity and whatnot. So the cost of certain aspects has been reduced dramatically, and some other things have increased substantially. As I say, travel nowadays, just basic commuting, I don't know what it's like, you know, in Sydney, but to get from any of the suburbs into the center core, you know, is as bad as trying to get into London. You know, like it's just, you're looking at 4 hours of driving just to be able to get into the door. So one of the things that I like is the balance point of things, because I honestly see there's a sweet spot where you've got a core team of people that are doing the face-to-face, that are doing the flying. And for the rest of the power teams, if you will, that's, you know, that are more the execution of the tactics or whatnot, it's the handoff that becomes important.
Yes, you know very I mean? Much so.
And to me, when I look at those secondary teams that don't have to be face-to-face, there is a certain degree, as you say, getting people trained properly. You don't have to bring them to a big conference. You can have a small conference with powerful players and release that on your intranet at very little cost, right? So that self-training and all that, and there's all these other aspects of community building. We're seeing social tools coming into the workplace to get a sense for that. Who is that person in that cube? I'm a military guy in terms of, you know, my family history. It's very hard to kill someone that you know. It's very easy to kill someone that you don't. So it's the same thing when you see cultures falling apart in a business, it's because they don't know the person that they're insulting.
Exactly. And this is that's back to the point and traveling to places. I mean, as you know, I've done a lot of travel through China and Europe in the last few months. And my view, for example, on China is very different, having been there a number of times now. And particularly when you attempt to speak Chinese and communicate in the culture, you really step in. I think that that's I've radically changed my view. And one of the reasons I'm so interested in China, it is a fifth of the world's population. It's an economic force that is just finding its legs. There's massive opportunities from that growing up, from the little child of China into the big, into the next stage of adolescence, comes with its problems, but massive opportunities. And again, that's a state control there where when I'm in China, I can't get to my social media platforms. Internet is it's just not very reliable. You can be in the top of the range hotels and internet is unreliable. So you literally have to talk to people on the phone and face to face because, Not every situation in China is like that, but certainly I found it unreliable in China. When you think of that, a fifth of the world's population, and you think of the limitations there from our business model, it's not neatly transposable. Europe is very different. Europe, I find, is a well-oiled machine. When you're going between Italy and France and Germany, there's this wonderful hub, very efficient through the airports and trains, and it's very easy to do business, very easy to connect up. And even there, although LinkedIn, for example, is used a lot to check people out, etc., nothing beats being in the air clubs, the airport clubs, and talking to people, saying hello to people and meeting and mingling there and sharing business cards. And again, old school 50s style, right? But very, very powerful way of doing things. So very different cultures. And yet Europe's attempting to do a lot of business with China. So I think the integration piece, anybody who's stepping into this this space, the international thing is very appealing and there are many opportunities, but I think we've got to step into their space. We've got to be the ones not to wait. I had many misconceptions about China before I went over there and actually experienced it for myself. For example, one of the things people were saying is plenty of people are speaking English and learning English because they all want to come to the West. It's very quick. You get into a Chinese city and you find nobody wants to speak English. Nobody speaks English. And very quickly, you can get stuck. You go to a meeting and nobody wants to speak, nobody speaks English. I was completely shocked, even in the major hotels, et cetera, et cetera. There's some English, but it's not as if everyone's queuing up to learn English. What an opportunity that is, you know. And I've been just learning Chinese on my iPhone. That's all I've used. I haven't had one lesson face-to-face with anybody. Just, you know, so that's another use of the technology, right? Just sitting in a cab, doing the hard graft.
We have the tools where theoretically you could provide your script to an app that'll translate it for you. And at that point in time, you can learn it. But nothing beats, I think, the local dialect, the local vibe. And I think this goes back to your point, you have to be feet on the ground if you really are going to truly get it.
Here's the thing, right? It's the promise. And again, the web selling itself. The web does a great job of selling itself. I thoroughly explored language technology. I'm hooked up with a few polyglot communities because I'm learning multiple languages as an experiment. I've got to tell you, the idea of this translation tools, etc., the fundamental flaw there is no generic translation. Every individual is different. Every human I've dealt with in China is completely different. They've got their own part of their own way they use language. And to really show, really communicate, I use all the translation services I can because I receive a lot of stuff in Chinese now that I have to quickly work out what's going on. That's a long, hard road to hoe. Unless you've got an expert translator who can read and get the nuance, et cetera, who understands. I've had translators in meetings, Robert, that speak Mandarin, but because they weren't in on the nuance of the deal, it was like a complete basket case in the meeting because nuance wasn't able to be translated because it's what's not said, it's what's said, it's how it's said, et cetera. So even though I had literal translation, it still didn't make sense. You know, the only way it'll make sense is when I speak it.
And I think that's the one thing that I do like about your creative side. It steps in and tells your commercial side, hey, you need to be creative in these spaces if you're going to be that much more successful. Because as you say, you're constantly balancing two parts of your personality, both, logical and creative.
But the other thing is there's a lot of people out there competing for the dollars, especially in these big companies. Why do we target the big companies? Because the big companies have the massive budgets, you know, and sales 101, go where the money is. But to show fresh twist, we're up against the big consulting firms. We're up against premium brands, et cetera. But guess what? Very few of them will walk in the door and say, oh, I'm now negotiating in Mandarin, you know, because who's got the time to take to go and learn that? Well, we have the tools and the technology. So what I'm saying is offering fresh twist. It's really important to differentiate yourselves. I'm not saying, you know, that's just one example that I use. The other thing is we make sure we're absolutely up to speed on the technology. Despite everything I've said, we have to know what people are using, how they're using it, when they're using it, and why they're using it.
Regardless of the technology, regardless of the opportunity, that always seems to be step one. How do you differentiate yourself on X? How do you differentiate yourself on the internet? How do you differentiate yourself on YouTube? How do you differentiate yourself on Twitter? You know, how do you differentiate yourself in a day-to-day business operation?
Absolutely. Fundamental. And why did we choose China? Because fifth of the world's population is industrializing. Most of the big companies are wanting to do business there have failed dismally or in various stages of disarray. It's an unsolved problem. And to me, the business model is always find people with problems and money. So if you've got, I can answer a tick to both those boxes. You don't want people just with problems and no money. You don't want people with money and no problems. You want people with problems that have money, right? And I can tell you that Chinese thing is blinking both. big time. And it's not the Chinese that have got the money. It's the people trying to do business with China that have got the money that are going, please look after my interests over there or help me work my way through there. That's a very large emerging opportunity. But that could be the equivalent of choosing a style of art or opening a certain bread shop or whatever. You have to be able to differentiate if you're going to command premium dollar.
You brought up Seth Godin earlier. Otherwise, you're just for a race for the bottom dollar, which is basically free, if not less than free, which is even worse because you're bankrupting yourself in a less than free.
Well, that's true. And I mean, I like Seth Godin's model. My only problem with Seth Godin is he talks about this idea of the purple cow. You know, what's the purple cow as a differentiator? Hang on a minute. Everybody's purple cowing now. So,
and everything is awesome. Nothing's awesome anymore.
Yeah, exactly. What happens when everybody's famous? What the web, next iteration of the web must deliver is somewhere differentiating. But if everybody's on there doing everything all the time, to me, it's the last place to be to find any kind of value and differentiation. I'll give you a quick example. Down at our local library, two very, very good librarians that are ignored by most people. I built a relationship with those two librarians where they are truly trained librarians. They're young and they're exciting people. They both trawl the shelves of everything new that comes in. They know exactly what I'm looking for. And they give me fresh twist every week. Now, that is a face-to-face. You know, sometimes I take them down some pastries or whatever, I tell them about my mad trips overseas. I care about them. They care about me. That's a great way. I get fresh twist ideas all the time from those two. We have to be different, right? Nobody else is down there doing it. Of all the hundreds of thousands of people that live around here, Robert, there's nobody else doing that, right?
Almost like a sleight of hand. While everybody else is trying to be different on the internet, you go where the masses aren't. I used to use a joke, and it's a bad one, but you know, when has a social network failed? When the marketers have taken over it.
My inspiration will not come from web, though for art, the good thing about web, for example, on Facebook, I follow many people who procure art from history. So I can very quickly get styles and updates on what's going on. So from a visual point of view, it's a really good reference tool. But in terms of business and everybody's doing the same thing, generalization, the last place I look now is the web, because I think that's where it's been laundered. Children learn very quickly that if you take all the different colors of plasticine and mix them up, you end up with poo brown, right? That poo brown plasticine. I think what's happened to the web, it's achieved finally poo brown plasticine. Like you say, everything is awesome and it's poo brown, okay? I need fresh twists for clients so I can charge my premium. I'm not finding it there. I'm finding it in the airport lounges. I'm finding it in the libraries. I'm finding it down on the beachfront. I'm finding it anywhere else but the web. And I don't want to put it on the web because then it becomes part of the sameness, right? It
goes back to what I quite often refer to as that outsider viewpoint. You know, it's taken me a while to realize it, but that's the one thing that I bring to the equation. And that transcends the web, which is why I'm quite happy with that, because it's something that is not disposable, if you will.